Hello and welcome to The Post Podcast. I'm Jack Horgan-Jones. In today's episode, I'm joined by Susan Mitchell to discuss the fallout from former HSE boss Tony O'Brien's explosive interview in the paper last week. We'll be looking at Fine Gael MEP Brian Hayes' decision to quit politics and what it means for the party and next year's European elections. And we're also taking a look at the US midterm elections. Finally, we're going to have an update on how Pascal Donoghue got on when he went to bat against European plans for a digital tax in Brussels. But first, as I mentioned, I'm joined by our health editor, Susan Mitchell. Susan, your interview with Tony O'Brien at the weekend, I think it's fair to say it somewhat caught the public imagination.
Yeah, I think that's encapsulated it pretty well. It was obviously the first interview that Tony O'Brien did since he left office at what was a very tumultuous time in the health service, because it was at the peak of the cervical check crisis. So I think there was a lot of interest in what he had to say, both about politicians and in particular the Public Accounts Committee, but from within health circles, there's a lot of interest in what he has actually had to say about the health service itself.
Mm. Have you been surprised, particularly with reference to the ongoing media coverage, because it was picked up by nearly everyone and everyone has run bulletins on it? How do you think that has played out? And have you been surprised at the tone of that at all?
Well, I think it's interesting. Obviously, Tony O'Brien was quite critical of Simon Harris.
The frightened little boy, as he called him.
That's right.
Which was kind of the soundbite. That became the soundbite for nearly all the coverage thereafter.
It did. And I think it's interesting. There's obviously been blowback or from various different members of the government and TDs in government to that. I mean, it's not the most vicious comment someone could make about somebody, but I'm sure the minister wasn't overly delighted to hear that he had been described like that by the person who was the most senior public servant in health. And it's quite unusual for a former public servant to be so direct and honest in his views. But I think it's interesting that no politician in government has reacted to the actual substance of his criticisms of what they're doing or not doing in health. They've concentrated on his criticism of Simon Harris and indeed the Public Accounts Committee. But if you move on from the frightened little boy comments and actually examine his criticism of Simon Harris and indeed the government, it would be very hard to disagree with how he actually characterised the government's initial response to cervical check. And a bit like the HSE's, it was a train wreck. Mm. And I'll give you a few examples. One, we obviously had the Taoiseach saying that no woman would have to go to court to prove negligence. That was never possible. And it was a remarkable thing for the Taoiseach to say, because it was never doable. Mm. We had the health minister offer a free smear test to every woman in the country. This is having real repercussions throughout the health service. And actually, sadly, it is going to lead to delayed investigations and potentially to delayed diagnoses, because the system has been overwhelmed by frightened women. There was no medical rationale behind that offer.
I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the scandal as it was breaking, was it almost that the government, in an effort to show how seriously it was taking it, kind of overpromised and then overpromised to a point whereby they couldn't avoid but underdeliver thereafter?
I think the government was under intense pressure, because if you remember back at the time, the way in which this crisis or controversy was being portrayed widely and both in the media and by politicians was that the HSE and indeed doctors had been engaged in a widespread cover-up of results. Mm. Much of the population believed that cancer diagnoses had been withheld from women. Mm. So in other words, that the health service and doctors knew that women had cancer and had not told them. And sadly, that inaccuracy still prevails today. I still meet people who think that. So into that frenzied environment, the government, to be fair to it, came under intense pressure to be seen to act and to be seen to be seen to take this issue very seriously. But they made a number of mistakes, and to the minister's credit, he has acknowledged that he made mistakes initially. He has said that, and I think as this controversy has rolled on, they have tried to calm public fears about this. But for example, I mentioned the cervical check offer. Mm. that still exists today. There is no medical rationale for it. Clinics are swamped, GPs are swamped, the labs can't cope, and women are waiting 5 months for their results. That was not a sensible move, and yet they haven't rolled back on it yet.
Just to come back to the coverage of the last few days as well, and the degree to which it's focused on the language as opposed to the substance, has that disappointed you?
It has. I understand there was a lot of colourful content in the interview, so, of course, that was going to get picked up, and there was going to be interest in what he had said.
But it was kind of horse-racy as well. It was like, official says something about government or about politicians. Politicians, what do you say in response?
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, actually parsing what he said.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's disappointing that the focus, and we've already focused quite a bit on cervical check. Cervical check is one aspect of the health service, which encompasses very, very many different issues and areas. And, you know, in his interview, Tony O'Brien made some really important points about the way in which the health service is run, about how difficult he found it to prioritise the things he thought were important and to, you know, implement certain strategies because he was prevented from doing so by politics or politicians. You know, he referenced the controversial plan that was developed for Portlaoise Hospital, which proposed closing the emergency department. He said that we had far too many, double the amount of emergency departments that we actually need in Dublin. But again, any suggestion or efforts to change or restructure this have been blocked by politicians. He pointed to Navan and worryingly described it as an emergency department he would not go to. He spoke about what he regarded as a suboptimal structure of the ambulance service in Dublin, about the government not doing enough to tackle recruitment and retention, specifically and mainly of hospital consultants. He outlined frightening statistics in smaller hospitals. He said something needed to be done to incentivize nurses in certain areas, as in, you know, additional pay for specific specialties. And I suppose I am disappointed that none of these are getting a look in the coverage yet, but that might change in the coming days.
It might change, but one of the things that he said as well, which I thought was interesting, was that he basically had to allot his time in inverse proportion to what he wanted to do, that he spent an awful lot of time firefighting. And I think actually this story that you wrote over the weekend and how it's been picked up thereafter is a good example of how issues around health all of a sudden become hypercharged and everyone becomes super sensitive, and you end up discussing the tip of the iceberg as opposed to the iceberg itself.
That's right. I mean, we're actually, over the last couple of days, what we've seen is the only discussion has been around whether or not the minister is or isn't a frightened little boy.
Yeah.
And really, that is, you know, it was
How do we make that better? I mean, like, is there a responsibility on us in the media to perhaps be a little more considered as well?
Oh, I think definitely there is. This is a long-standing problem in health that we don't really get underneath the bonnet. And I include myself in that. I'm not trying to criticise other people who cover health. I make the same mistakes.
Because there's a lot of low-hanging crisis fruit, isn't there? I mean, in a slow news week, it's almost as if the reflexive news stance is to go, well, you know, what's the trolley count? And, you know, does that actually help what is a quite, you know, bedeviled by problems health service?
I think we prioritise the sensationalist and the emotive all the time. And I think we don't do enough on the more serious issues, and we don't actually get under the bonnet of enough, exactly, of what's happening. For example, what really we should be doing in the media this week, and myself included, is looking at what he said about Dublin emergency departments. Has a proposal been submitted? What has been done to examine the number of emergency departments we actually do need for a capital city of this size? We should be examining these underlying issues. And it's a criticism I hear from people working in the health service all the time, that all we do in the media is criticise, and sensationalise. And we rarely...
Yeah, I think it is the media's job to point at problems. I mean, our job is not to become some kind of, you know, applausy echo chamber and say, God, isn't everything great? And look, this fella here did a great job last week. The job is to point out problems, but there is a scale within that.
Yeah, there's a balance to be struck as well. There are people out there offering ideas and solutions as to how progress can be made, and they're not often given the voice that they should.
So Tony O'Brien, right? He doesn't seek the job. He's appointed to it. He spends a few years firefighting and, you know, getting kicked around at committees, and then is unceremoniously kicked out just before he decides to retire. How is that in any way an ad for the job of chief executive of the HSE, and how does it affect the kind of attractiveness of that post?
It's a very good question, because actually, if you look at both the job for director general, which was his post, I am hearing that there have not been a huge number of applicants for that job. But also, they recently advertised for positions on the board of the HSE, and they were forced to actually extend that. It now closes today, which would suggest again that there wasn't a rush to apply for these jobs. So I think
you wouldn't go for it yourself. In keeping with the new tradition of former Sunday Business Post journalists joining boards of state companies.
I'm not that crazy. But I think that one of the points he made about the way in which public and civil servants can be questioned at the Public Accounts Committee is a very legitimate criticism. This doesn't apply to all members of the Public Accounts Committee, or indeed all members of different Doyle committees, but sometimes there is a very demeaning approach taken to witnesses who come before those committees. And of course, they need to be held to account. They need to be asked tough, hard questions, especially when things go wrong. But I actually don't think showing them the level of disrespect that some politicians do does the public any service.
Susan, just to finish up, what concerned you the most about what Tony O'Brien said to you last week?
Two things. One was what he had to say about medical recruitment and retention, and also the difficulty. Actually, three now, sorry. I could go on, but I'll try and rein myself in. Also, what he said about GPs, the desperate need for the government to make peace with them. And he outlined serious concerns about the ability of GPs to provide universal primary care, which is where we would all get, you know, GP, free GP care at the point of access. But I think the third thing is what he said about Sláintecare, which is this overarching vision for the health service, the so-called reform plan. And he expressed real concerns about the government's actual appetite to progress this, and the money allocated in the recent budget to Sláintecare would confirm those fears when you actually delve into the figures. And I think that's a real problem, because if we continue to run the health service in the way that we do at present, it's so badly structured, we are going to continue to have an extremely expensive system that is going to go over budget. And before long, we're actually going to be the highest per capita spenders on healthcare in the EU, despite having massive waiting lists.
Well, obviously, we'll be looking to you for more coverage of this weekend and in the weeks to come. Our health editor, Susan Mitchell, many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, now to discuss Brian Hayes' decision to quit politics, and also to have a look at what's going on in the American midterm elections, I'm joined by our political correspondent, Hugh O'Connell, and our news correspondent, Colette Sexton. Thanks, guys, very much for coming in.
No problem, Jack.
No problem, Jack. Thanks for having us.
No worries. Hugh, Brian Hayes stepping down after a fairly long and actually quite colourful career in politics today. Was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, I think it came as a big shock. It was the expectation that he was going to run for re-election to the European Parliament next May. Or if not that, that he would return to domestic politics at one point. Lots of speculation about him running for Richard Bruton's seat out in Dublin Bay North. Richard Bruton probably going to retire in the next few years. So the fact that he's leaving politics altogether and taking up this position as chief executive of the Irish Banking and Payments Federation,
BFI.
Basically lobbying for the bankers.
And he's been doing a lot of work on that, actually, in Europe. He's been doing a lot of work on capital markets union, stuff like that. He's been fairly prominent on the economics committee. I mean, he did in some ways kind of serve as that link man between Fine Gael government here and Brussels, and particularly on those kind of economic issues, including taxation. Will they miss him, do you think?
Well, I think that raises the question with regards to what conflict of interest might exist there, given that he's serving now for another 6 months in this job as an MEP for Dublin and serving on the Econ Committee, as you mentioned, and so on. That, you know, is it appropriate that he sits in that position for another 6 months and then goes off to join the Banking and Payments Federation. But in terms of whether Fine Gael will miss him or not, I think they will. I think Brian's he's a good strategic mind. That said, he was the party's
director of elections.
For the 2016 general election, and that didn't go too well. But he's always been a good performer for them, I think, and I think particularly of his time as junior finance minister in between 2011 and 2014, where he was going out to bat for the government week after week when Michael Noonan, the finance minister, was inflicting pretty serious austerity. He was kind of fronting up and defending that and defending all of that government did.
And he has said that was his most enjoyable time period in politics, which is very interesting considering how stressful it must have been at the time as well. But I think the most interesting thing about this is that a politician has kept his word. So he pledged to leave politics by the age of 50, and he's currently 49.
When he was 24.
That's very impressive.
It's a long
and
term.
And Leo apparently also has met that promise.
Yeah, Leo's long talked about leaving politics before he's 50 or leaving, not being in politics
12 years to go
until he's 60 odd, like, the likes of Enda Kenny and Michael Noonan. So
It helps when you're Taoiseach at 38.
Yeah. apparently he restated that promise in his conversation with Brian Hayes in the last couple of days when Hayes was informing him that he was stepping down. So that's kind of interesting. But from Hayes's point of view, I suppose one of the pivotal moments in his career was in 2010 when he backed he didn't back Enda Kenny, bluntly.
So he backed the wrong horse. This is when Richard Bruton...
In the attempted heave against Enda Kenny in 2010, when Richard Bruton basically tried to take over as leader of the party. And Hayes didn't back... was a senior figure within the party under Enda Kenny, backed the other horse in the race, and was demoted and, was made a junior minister, it has to be said, but was probably on course for cabinet before he went against Kenny in 2010. Yeah. And that sort of changed his career path.
Like, do you think they learned from that and from since? I mean, the most recent situation like that was with Varadkar and Simon Coveney, and people that backed Simon Coveney weren't punished as much as Brian Hayes.
Do they need to kind of to keep people in the broad church?
It depends on the personality of the leader at the time. I mean, you can argue, people who backed... Simon Coveney in the leadership race just last year weren't punished, but then you can see an awful lot of people who did back Leo Varadkar who were left in jobs that perhaps those jobs would have benefited from them moving on elsewhere. I don't think we'll get into that now, but certain junior ministers have caused issues for Leo Varadkar in recent weeks. Pat Breen is one of them. Catherine Byrne is another, for example. But Leo Varadkar had got their support on the basis that he was going to leave them where he was or where they were. So it very much depends on the personality of the leader. Enda Kenny was a little bit vindictive with some people in 2011 when he became Taoiseach. He would have he did promote Brian Hayes, he did promote Lucinda Creighton, but both might have got into cabinet. He dropped people like Michael Creed, for example, who had to wait years before he got in.
I just want to bring it back to Brian Hayes, or more accurately, I want to throw it forward to the European elections next year, Hugh. This means, so Dublin is currently a 3-seater. It means that himself and Nessa Childers are going, it's going to become a 4-seater, correct?
That's right.
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, effectively, there's kind of 3 seats up for grabs. How do you think this decision to retire will factor in?
There's a Sinn Féin MEP, Lynn Boylan, who should get re-elected, I would have thought. So then, you've got 3 extra seats. Now, one of them has to be Fine Gael, you would think, given their level of support nationally, and they're particularly strong in Dublin. I mean, their own internal poll.
Any whispers as to candidates?
Shows them very, very strong in Dublin. In terms of candidates, I suppose if you look at the subs for Brian Hayes, Neil Richmond, the senator who's been big on Brexit over the last 2 years, would be sort of a prime candidate, but he is running for the Dáil. An outside bet could be Lucinda Creighton coming back into the party. Obviously got her consultancy business up and running. She's working over in Europe quite a lot. She is a former Europe minister, of course. Now, she has severed all ties with Fine Gael. That said, she is a close personal friend of Leo Varadkar's. So it would be a surprise for sure. She has said to me in an interview previously that she wouldn't be running in the European elections in 2019. But given Brian Hayes is not running, that does create an opportunity perhaps for her that didn't exist beforehand.
That would be a real test of Fine Gael's capacity for big heartedness and inclusiveness after
falling. Well,
out.
I mean, the Taoiseach has always said that Fine Gael is a broad church, right?
So, yeah.
And as I said, they are, himself and Lucinda go back years and years. They're still very friendly. They still go out for dinner now and again. So I don't think there would be any issue with her coming back into the party.
And the other 2 seats?
Labour, I think, are running Alex White, or certainly he's running for the nomination anyway. He's the former communications minister. And the Greens have Ciarán Cough, who I think could be in with a good chance. You know, you've got people like Nessa Childers not stepping down. Her vote came from all over the place. Fianna Fáil will obviously want to win a seat. No word yet on their candidate, as far as I know. But they will have to think that if they want to be kind of, you know, doing well nationally, they have to be taking a seat in Dublin, where obviously they've been very weak for the last few years.
Okay, I want to change our focus across the Atlantic, where obviously we have the US midterm elections, many people seeing it as a referendum on Trump's presidency so far. Colette, what will you be keeping an eye on this evening and tomorrow?
The change of that discussion brings me back to that quote of Boston to Berlin and which one we're closer to. But yeah, it's a very interesting one. So the midterms are traditionally seen as a kind of referendum on the president because they're held halfway through the president's four-year term. And this one in particular, there's been $5 billion spent in it to date. 36 million votes have already been cast in early voting, which is the highest ever. So there is a lot of interest. And that's probably because Trump is such a polarizing candidate. Like, so many people either love him or hate him. So this will be seen as a victory for him or a loss for him, depending on how it goes. It's a very interesting one. Now, there are lots to be decided in the midterm. So there's all 435 seats in the US House of Representatives. There's a third of the seats in the US Senate, 36 state governorships, 3 US territory governorships, several city mayorships and local officials, and then more than 150 ballot measures. I mean, you know, we get confused going to the polls with the, you know, the presidential election and one referendum. That's a lot of votes.
Yeah,
out there.
Yeah, so there's a lot of votes. I mean, it would seem kind of there's all to play for, but the polls would suggest, certainly, I mean, if you can still trust polls after the last few years, but they would suggest that it looks like the House is going to be returned to Democratic control while the Senate is going to be held by Republicans. That's kind of the central scenario. What does, Hugh, maybe, what does a good day, an exceptionally good day for Democrats and conversely an exceptionally good day for Republicans look like, to the degree that it might deviate from that central scenario?
Well, I think there's around 60 seats up for grabs in the House that are kind of considered too close to call. Now, if you drill down into that, there's 30 that are, I suppose, real kind of toss-up races, and the Democrats only need to win 8 of them to flip the House back into their corner. Republicans would have to get 23. So, but I suppose really from the Democrats' point of view, a strong majority in the House as opposed to just, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 seats would be indicative of this kind of blue wave that they've spoken about, for example. Obviously, there are a couple of Senate races as well that are where, you know, people are kind of keeping a close eye on. I mean, particularly, for example, in Texas, where we have this guy, Beto O'Rourke, this congressman, who this real insurgent congressman who's kind of big selling point, I suppose, is that he's youthful, he's young, he's kind of hip and cool.
And not Ted Cruz.
And not Ted Cruz, who is hated even in the Republican Party, I think.
Obviously the Beto O'Rourke versus Ted Cruz race is a big one, but would you go as far as to call it a kind of bellwether? Like, I mean, it is.
I don't think I would, because I mean, you know, Texas is a very red state, for example, so it's unlikely that Beto O'Rourke is going to win. I mean, it would be an amazing night for the Democrats if he did win, because it would be indicative of them picking up Senate seats that they weren't expected to pick up, for example. But I suppose what these races show, and this election, these midterm elections show, is that if you have a situation where the Democrats take back the House, but the Republicans increase their number of seats in the Senate, well, then it shows a country that's very divided. It shows that the Senate is much more representative of kind of smaller rural states. The Senate, we should remind our listeners, is basically made up of 2 representatives from each state. So it's not based on population or how many people live in that state or anything like that, or
whereas
how large
Congress
that
is.
State is. Whereas Congress is. So the Congress, or the House of Representatives, is made up of much more, you know, kind of densely urban populated areas. It's much more representative of that. So what it does show is a deeply divided United States. Obviously, we saw that in 2016. We could see Democrats, for example, win overall the popular vote on the night tonight, but ultimately the Senate is, if the Senate remains in Republican control, that then it can still do an awful lot.
Colette, I want to ask you, is there a danger? So, I mean, as we say, you know, the central scenario is that, you know, it's probably going to be a good enough day for Democrats, and usually it's a bad day for the incumbent president. You know, we saw in 2010 Obama suffered quite significant losses. So given that is the case, is there perhaps a danger in overinterpreting a good day for the Democrats as like a rejection of Trump and Trumpism writ large?
Well, Trump's approval rating in the polls currently stands at 39% overall. 55% of people are disapproving of him, which is less, has fallen on last month. So that's the worst pre-election approval rating for any president approaching their first midterm election. But at the end of the day, Trump is still going to be president no matter what happens. And he'll still have broad power over foreign policy. He'll still be able to renegotiate trade deals and all that kind of thing. So, I mean, we can overstate this, but it is still very important to see how America is going to vote on it and what decisions they're going to make. And one of the biggest things that the Democrats have going for them is their support of healthcare policy. And a lot of people, both Democrat and Republican, are worried about the changes that might be made to Obamacare under the Trump administration, which could see things like people who might have long-term medical problems such as cancer, their insurance companies being able to cancel their cover halfway through their treatment. So that's a big worry for people on both sides.
Okay, well, all eyes on the Boston side of the equation tonight. Colette Sexton, news correspondent, and Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent. Many thanks for coming in today.
Well, we'll engage with the commission. We will work on the commission in relation to any ideas that they have. But we have been consistent over the last year in outlining our view that this proposal will create great issues. In particular, we have the strong concern that moving the tax incident into where the consumption occurs in the market, as opposed to where value is created, will set a precedent that will be really difficult for exporting economies, will be really difficult for economies for whom the service industry is a big part of their economy, and I think sets a precedent for Europe overall as a net exporter that we should take great care with.
Okay, that was Pascal Donoghue speaking in the aftermath of the Ecofin meeting. I'm joined now by our markets editor, Ian Guider, to discuss the goings-on in Brussels. Ian, European finance ministers meeting today with tax on the agenda, and invariably that means that Ireland is on the menu, right?
Yeah, of course it is, and we desperately would like not to be talking about tax at a European level, because of course that brings up all the things that go on in Ireland with multinational companies. What we'd really like to do is to get this issue of a digital tax out of the European Union and kick it off into the OECD, who will inevitably take a long time to come up with a plan of their own, because of course they need more than just a European on board. They need other nations to buy into it. But you do get a sense, listening to some of the commentary by European finance ministers, that they do think, or they are coming around to this idea, that a digital tax on some of these big companies is a good idea. Bruno Le Maire, the French finance minister, who's been one of the people who have proposed this and wanted it in by the end of this year, has said at this meeting on the fringes, like everybody else who do these doorsteps, look, perhaps we can delay it by another year or so and perhaps bring it to 2020 in a bid to get the wavering nations on board. And there are a couple of ways. Wavering nations. We are not wavering. We are fully against the idea of a digital tax. But the Danish finance minister, he had an interesting comment on it and saying that, well, you know, if we go ahead with this, well, we're going to get the US retaliation because, of course, who are the majority of companies that will be affected by this? They will be American companies. And given that Donald Trump is going to be in the White House for another couple of years and has shown no stopping of his trade wars or sanctions.
Sort of a predilection for conflict. Maybe.
Yeah. And you saw that poster of him saying sanctions were coming against Iran earlier on this week. Who knows what type of artwork from cinema he could get to have a retaliation against the European Union if they went ahead with a digital sales tax. Now, you kind of look at some of the other things that are going on around this, and you and I spoke about this last week, in which the Irish position is clear. It looked like Germany over the summer were opposing this. Who knows, given the difficulties Angela Merkel's government are going in, whether they might say, well, perhaps we might be in favour of it. Some of the other European countries, again, the French, who have been the driving force behind this, perhaps making a few concessions, but looking like they still want to push this in some way, shape or form. And perhaps, given that Italy are also looking at some sort of measure unilaterally along with the Spanish, perhaps there's no way of getting around this.
Yeah, so a couple of things jumped out at me today. I think you correctly flagged that the Danish finance minister was one of the people who has kind of made some indifferent noises, perhaps might be the best way of putting it, about the possibility of a digital sales tax. Now, that to me is interesting, right, for a couple of reasons, because who has been front and center centre of the European Union and the European Commission's crusade against tax planning. It's been Margrethe Vestager, who is Danish, who is the European Competition Commissioner, and a lot of her team and the people around her are from Denmark. So while a lot of the kind of political momentum for a digital sales tax and for a crackdown more generally on multinational tax planning has been coming from the French, I think a lot of the kind of intellectual heft and a lot of the kind of technocratic expertise has been around Margrethe Vestager and her team, and they are, as I say, Danish. So it's interesting to see the Danes kind of quibbling about it. Another interesting thing is this idea, first floated actually by Brian Hayes, the first person I heard talking about was Brian Hayes, that there would be a sunset clause on any digital sales tax which would be introduced. Now, nominally that is to kind of get the wavering parties, Ireland included, on board, because it says, look, let's go ahead and introduce it. Let's do it for a period of 3 to 5 years. And then in 3 to 5 years, if the OECD has come up with a global approach, well, then we can put the digital sales tax away. Obviously, Ireland, Sweden, Denmark, everyone who's in that camp is suspicious of this, because once you take that genie out of the bottle, obviously, it's very hard to get in, and it'd be even harder to wean bigger economies like Germany and France off the tax revenues that presumably they would be enjoying in the intervening period.
Yeah, I've never seen a tax taken off anybody in the past, so it'd be very hard.
Apart from the hotels industry.
Well, and they probably should have got that tax break, but that's another argument. Yeah, I mean, once you start doing something, you see the money flowing in from it, well, then it's very hard to say, well, we could do without this now. Look, there's all sorts of compromise suggestions. There was another suggestion from the French finance minister that perhaps Ireland could be compensated if there was a loss of tax revenues being passed. Pascal Donoghue was hinting at that in his doorstep over at the ECOFIN meeting. I think the wider point here is there is a renewed push. I mean, I think we thought over the summer that when this idea had
that it had kind
floated,
of gone into abeyance.
It had gone into abeyance, and that there would be a push at a global level through the OECD to deal with it, which would kick it down the line for a number of years. That doesn't seem to be happening, and the fresh impetus coming from not just that British move last week, but other countries looking at it, I think Ireland have to be really careful over the next couple of weeks, particularly because Brexit negotiations are ongoing, that people don't lose sight of the fact that there is a push amongst Europe and some countries who aren't so caught up in the Brexit talks that they could push this behind the scenes and we could be bounced into it. I still think, and I've been having this conversation with people, it does look like there's some sort of inevitability that perhaps we want to be on the right
side.
Yeah,
that's true, but I don't really sense, I mean, just listening to the doorstep that Pascal Dominic did, I don't get the sense that he's in the mood for concession making just yet. I mean, the arguments that he was putting out were very much, you know, the staple set of arguments that we're used to. This is for the OECD. This is bad for countries with large service economies and obviously exporting countries. Guess who the audience for that argument is? It's the Germans. So I don't get the sense that the Department of Finance, that Leo Varadkar or Pascal Donoghue are quite ready to kind of say, yeah, let's play ball yet.
No, we're fully behind the US multinationals who will be at most affected by this, but there does come a point where, do we really want to be seen as to tax is an issue where you can wield a veto? Do you want to be seen as wielding a veto on this, or really burning up all your capital around this matter? Because of course we're all waiting on that appeal hearing to start at some point in time with the Apple ruling. We really don't want to be on the wrong side of taxation argument, because there are changes coming globally. There's a political mood out there, and remember, we're heading into European elections next year. I think people are a bit fed up with the European austerity and might want to see that perhaps, look, if we're going to raise money to start spending, why don't we take it from multinationals, particularly American multinationals, because there are very few European digital sales companies that will be affected by this. Like, the only one I could think of that would have a kind of a global reach would be the likes of Spotify from Sweden, that would have a huge global turnover that could be affected, and maybe one or two other digital companies out there. So this is primarily seen as US multinationals, and are they going to find favour in Europe, given all that's going on around Facebook and their involvement in elections, particularly in around the Brexit vote and the Cambridge Analytica scandal?
Whiff factor off these companies already. One thing I think that is interesting as well, though, and it's something that our colleague Hugh O'Connell picked up on in the paper at the weekend, is the Labour Party in Ireland, and maybe electorally irrelevant, but they are of the political centre, and they're saying that they're behind the digital sales tax. Now, it used to be kind of, you know, shibboleth for the political centre in Ireland to be as one on on tax issues.
Unanimous that 12.5% is.
Yeah, I mean, even Sinn Féin, who would be seen as a party of the left and a redistributive party and a high tax party, are even on board on the 12.5%. Now, the fact that a centre political party is now aligning itself with Europe as opposed to Ireland Inc., do you think that's significant?
It is, and even more significant, there was a Financial Times editorial last week which was praising Philip Hammond for going ahead with it in the UK. Now, this is the paper of Global Business and Finance, and even it is seeing that these measures are perhaps necessary, not just for reasons of taxation has to change, but people are beginning to recognise that a certain fairness has to creep into the global tax system, and perhaps that we need to modernise it to take into account that, you know, Pascal Donohue is again saying, look, profits are taxed where the value is created, not where the service is consumed. Perhaps global taxation is moving, despite the best attempts of some people in the tax industry to try and keep it that way, that perhaps we are moving towards where it is at a consumption level, and that would be rocking the foundations of global tax, but sometimes that might be necessary.
Our favourite crappy band of superheroes met over the weekend.
The Hanseatic League.
The Hanseatic League. What would the superpowers of the Hanseatic League be? Tax planning?
They would be able to go to the minutia of the backs of very long academic books fairly quickly, which would be a pretty awful superpower.
It's not much of a superpower.
Terrible superpower, Jack. It's one that you'll probably have.
Yeah, but interestingly, they are inviting. They brought in Bruno Le Maire. They brought in German minister. So there's obviously a bit of a charm offensive at their dinners that happened the night before.
Yeah, I can imagine it being the nicest of dinners as well.
I know, very bad cuisine in the Hanseatic League, right?
Yeah,
Baltic. Nordic and Irish. There's not really a standout.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of carbs in that. You know, I mean, I have to say, I wouldn't exactly be staying around for the second course. But if you get around to it, you know, you've got countries as part of this league who are quite small. Let's be honest, and there comes a point in Europe when we are going to have to take that the big countries want to do something. You usually tend to bend to their will, as Greece found out in 2015 when it had to bow to German and French demands. Italy is even finding it a bit difficult at ECOFIN at the moment, so perhaps the Hanseatic League could do it more Justice League powers as opposed to Scandinavian superpowers. Yeah,
they need to get bitten by some sort of radioactive insect. Listen, it's Tuesday afternoon. In business-wise, what's on your agenda for the rest of the week? What's on your radar?
Yeah, kind of focusing more on domestic matters this week. A big shareholders meeting at Greencore is going to take place. It's selling off their US operations, so they're getting $1 billion for it. Probably just about going to wash their face on this deal, but more importantly, it gives Patrick Coveney an exit from a year or so of misery. It will go through.
Let me just jump in there. Patrick Coveney and exit. Is that a sentence we should be preparing ourselves for in the immediate future?
He has been chief executive for a decade now. He's been finance director before that. Does he really want to stick around with Greencore making sandwiches for the UK supermarket chains for another 5 or 10 years? I would struggle to see it.
If only a big CEO job in Irish PLCs had come up recently.
I kind of floated this idea with a couple of people who said, look, Patrick Coveney is a very skilled chief executive. Lots of consumer knowledge he would have, which is important in banking. However, in the modern world of finance, it'd be very hard to sell a non-banker or a non-CFO banker at the moment to the markets. A couple of other things I'm watching out for. Mallin PLC, which many people will be thinking, who PLC? The Irish state are an investor in this company. It invests in biotech and drug companies. They're having a big day in London this week to kind of sell their wares to investors. Share prices really tanked over the last year, and they're trying to reset.
Still a very ambitious share price target from one of the big stockbrokers earlier this week, right? Yeah. Davey, I think, put it at 15.90. Where is it? About 3.90?
The share price of Mallin is just hovering around £4. It was floated at a tenner about 3 years ago to investors, so you can see a huge amount of damage already to that share price. But the brokers think Mallin can reset what it does, get investors back on board, and in a few years' time, it could be worth €15.90. It's a very ambitious share price.
Yeah, no matter what happens, we are on the hook for it
because we are a major shareholder through the Irish Strategic Investment Fund, because the ISEF invests in lots of things on behalf of Irish taxpayers. Sometimes those bets go wrong, sometimes they go right.
Okay, listen, that's all for today's edition of the Post podcast. I'd like to thank all our guests for their time and contributions, and thanks to you, our listeners. We'll be back with the same guff, same time next week. Many thanks.